At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
On the program today, how to go about getting the change that is needed using the economic and the symbolic powers that you have. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, the 27th day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Athletes in at least five professional sports leagues, the NBA, the WNBA, Major League Baseball, Major League Soccer, and tennis, have decided, to paraphrase one of those athletes, that they are Black Americans first and athletes second, and so have decided not to play for the time being. The decision, of course, comes in the wake of the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin, the other day. Also, many other Black men and women in many other cities through time. These athletes want, fundamentally, police and criminal justice reform, right? Marketplace's Mario Segarra gets us going with what leverage those athletes actually have and how long it might last.
Last night, Elizabeth Williams, who plays for the WNBA's Atlanta Dream, made a statement. She and the other teams would not be playing. And she had an ask for their fans.
If you truly believe that Black Lives Matter, then vote. Go and complete the 2020 census now. Don't wait. If we wait, we don't make change.
Pro athletes have a platform. And in this case, they're using it to reach out directly to fans and viewers. Lori Latrice Martin calls what they're doing a strike. She teaches sociology and African American studies at Louisiana State University.
By striking, they're providing inspiration for those that are on the front line and those that are involved in various grassroots efforts.
But what about more direct financial pressure? The players are withholding their labor, hoping their demands will be met. That's a little trickier. When they refuse to play, that does hurt the bottom line for leagues and team owners who could try to force change.
The NBA is owned by billionaires, and billionaires do have a lot of power.
Eric Loomis, who teaches history at the University of Rhode Island, says owners could use that power to lobby state legislatures, like Milwaukee Bucks players are doing. They're trying to get Wisconsin lawmakers to pass police reform legislation. But
it's highly unlikely the Wisconsin legislature is going to listen to them because the Wisconsin legislature is dominated by pretty conservative Republicans who have been opposed to these protests and have been very supportive of the police.
In normal times, players would also have some leverage over local governments. When teams play in a city, that city collects tax dollars from parking and concessions. But there are no fans in stadiums right now, so they can't pull that lever. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
A quick swing by the labor market here. First of all, we got the now regularly abysmal reading on first-time claims for unemployment benefits this morning. A tad more than a million people lost their jobs in the week ending this past Saturday. Especially hard hit, restaurants. Even before the coronavirus, they were dealing with labor shortages. Now, the long hours and the low wages come with a threat of disease exposure. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
Michelle Kaufman owns The Paddle Trap, a burgers and comfort food type restaurant near Bismarck, North Dakota. And she spends a part of her day, every day, posting jobs on Indeed. For every dozen interviews, she nets about one hire, and they'll often last just a few shifts. When she asks why, they'll say,
"You know, I didn't realize how many people I was going to be around every day, and I don't really want to take this home to my family."
The virus is hurting her bottom line. The staffing shortage is annoying potential customers who are eager to eat out.
Guests will come in and we'll have to tell them that we're on a 30-minute wait and they don't understand why we would be on a wait when we have empty tables.
The restaurant industry came into the COVID crisis with a hiring problem. Lots of workers think of food jobs as transitional. Also, the food service industry was growing too fast, says the University of New Mexico's Eli Wilson, who's writing a book about restaurant labor.
There already was kind of more jobs to fill and maybe not enough bodies willing to do this kind of work.
Another factor, a lot of people who do this work are on the extreme ends of the age spectrum. Many are older workers who are more susceptible to the virus, and many are younger, living at home with parents. Alex Suskind directs the Food and Beverage Institute at Cornell.
The risks definitely outweigh the benefits for some of these folks. And if they need the money, they may be able to find other types of work that might be less risky.
Possibly, like retail or gig work, which can, sometimes, pay more than the average restaurant worker's salary of $22,000 a year. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Since May, the Census Bureau has been releasing a weekly survey on how small businesses are feeling. And in the latest figures released today, nearly 44% of respondents said their businesses have seen a moderate decline due to the pandemic. Well, we decided to do our own survey. Yes, unscientific, anecdotal, but with actual people and their actual stories. Last winter, we followed three small businesses through the holiday shopping season, and we have decided to give them a call back now that, well, you know, now that everything has changed, right? First up, an e-commerce company in downtown Los Angeles.
I'm Patty Delgado. I'm the founder and CEO of Hija de Tu Madre. We design apparel, accessories, and stationery that are all Latina-inspired. Our planners are basically our key item every year. And this year, we're having to order them even farther in advance than we normally would just to make sure that we have these planners on time. And I'm honestly like a little bit worried. This is our first year ordering inventory through a boat. And that takes a really long time. But, you know, at this point, that's like even a little bit more secure than getting things on a plane. I think the health of so many industries also impacts the well-being of my business. Like everything is interconnected. And I think that things just take longer because of sourcing. So I think like there really is kind of like this trickle effect, or like everything just feels so related. So I think no business or no industry is really totally immune to this.
That was Patty Delgado. She's the CEO of Hija de Tu Madre in Los Angeles, downtown L.A. Two more small business people coming up later on the program. On Wall Street today, honestly, kind of meh on Jay Powell's big inflation speech. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A couple of weeks ago, a series of storms ripped through the Midwest. Millions of acres of farmland were torn up, adding yet another thing to the long list of crises that American farmers have had to face the past couple of years. So we figured this would be a good time to get April Hemmes. She farms corn and soybeans in Franklin County, Iowa. We figured it'd be a good time to get her back on the phone to see how things are going. Hey, April, it's Kai. How are you?
I'm been better, but not too bad. Getting ready to go to...
Well, tell me more... Going to your niece's wedding. All right, we'll get there in a minute. Tell me why you've been better, though. I mean, it's been a couple of weeks since these storms. Did they hit you?
Do you want me to be recording now?
Of course I want you to be recording now.
Okay, there. Okay, start again. Go.
Okay, tell me about these storms. Did they hit you?
No, they were, fortunately for me, about 40 miles south of me it started. But imagine what is happening to Louisiana and Texas now happened in Iowa, only across the land. It was at times 140-mile-per-hour winds. And I tried to relate it. So if you're on the East Coast, it's from New York to D.C., 70 miles wide, and it flattened all of our crops. Tore up a lot of grain bins where we store our crops. Mm. It was devastating. 30% of the corn, they just came out today with new numbers, 30% of the corn crop is gone and 30% of the soybeans. So, and I was usually number one in corn, raising corn, and number two, I like to say number one, in soybeans. But remember, Illinois is number two, and it went across Illinois, too. And that's not enough, Kai, but wait, there's more.
Okay, go ahead.
I just looked at our drought monitor. Every single county in the state of Iowa is in a drought now. So that's how much fun it is farming in Iowa right now.
Yeah, I bet. So look, the drought's obviously going to hit you, but and
yeah,
farming,
has.
I'm sure, in Iowa is reasonably close-knit. You know a lot of those people 40 miles south whose crops got wiped out.
Yep.
What are they going to do? What are they telling you?
Well, we do have crop insurance, most of us, almost all. The banker makes us. But like I tell people, you don't buy crop insurance hoping it's just like car insurance or house insurance. You don't want a fire or an accident. We buy it just to cover our expenses to pay the bank back. So a lot of them are waiting for the crop adjusters to come out and tell them, you know, they're going to zero it out or they have to try to pick it, which, and you drove my combine. Imagine going
I did.
One way at a mile an hour and you were going 3.5. You kind of pushed it a couple times. You had the need for speed. So imagine doing that all day long, going one way, turn around, go back. So that's what they're looking at right now. I mean, it's like they lost their job and their house all in one day.
Right. And then you pile that on top of the pandemic and, oh, by the way, the China trade stuff, which is still going on, I'm sure, in terms of you guys not being able to sell your stuff. And it's like a triple whammy.
It is.
Yeah.
You know, what we're hearing, there's no way China's going to reach that goal. So, So the world is going to South America till they run out, and then they'll come to us for soybeans and corn. So, yeah.
So, yeah. Last time you and I talked to you, just put your crop in the ground. I mean, drought aside and all the terrible stuff that's happening, how's it going to go for you come harvest time? Do you have a guess?
I've had 2 inches of rain since July 1st. So, normally, I would have 5 times more than that. Corn will be okay, but the soybeans are really going to be hurting. We're going to take a yield hit this year, no doubt.
Sheesh. Okay, let's go out on a high note. The good news,
please.
Your niece is getting married. You're going on a road trip, right? You're
going to
have some fun?
My husband came home from work about 3 weeks ago and said, get me out of here. I need a vacation. So we toured the Black Hills. We went through South Dakota. That's where he was born.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was gorgeous and it was good. And the crops look really good there for those farmers. So, yeah, we're headed out to Minnesota, as they say it, today. And our positive note, our daughter's flying in from Seattle, so we get to see her. We haven't seen her since January. So looking forward to it.
Well, look, have a great time, and we'll call you soon, okay?
Okay. Thanks, Kai.
We've said it plenty here on the program, just today even with Kristen's story, that food service is a tough line of work right now. So to continue our survey of small businesses, we called our chocolatier.
I'm Kristen Tallheimer Bingham, co-owner of Dean Sweets, and I'm at our Cove Street store in Portland, Maine. So business in the last week has been pretty good. We have customers walking in. We have website orders. We have phone orders. It also doesn't feel really normal. And comparing this past week to last year, for example, we are at about 50% of normal. We have been considered essential because we're a food supplier. When the pandemic hit in March, we did curbside. So we didn't have any walk-in traffic, but our website orders just went through the roof. So I think investing in our website now is really something that will be helpful for us. When I'm working at our downtown Portland location, I do feel like things are coming back. So I see a lot more people walking by the store. I see a lot more people coming into the store. So things feel like they're coming back to life a little bit right now.
That was Kristen Tallheimer Bingham in Portland, Maine, the co-proprietor of Dean Sweets. Coming up,
you just never have seen so many people want to go fishing.
Oh, the pandemic hobbies, they do keep on growing, don't they? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 160 points today, about a half percent, 28,492. The NASDAQ lost 39 points, 0.3%, 11,625. The S&P 500 up 5 points, about a 10th percent, 34.84. $178,000, that's the average value of a Fannie Mae-backed mortgage on a single-family home in this country as of June 30. The government-sponsored mortgage finance company announced it is extending its temporary moratorium on foreclosures until the end of the year. That moratorium, put in place obviously because of the pandemic, had been set to expire at the end of this month. With the Jay Powell announcement on inflation that he's going to let it ride for a little while, quick look at banks. They're still seeing green. Bank of America deposited 1.9%. JP Morgan Chase increased 3.2%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note 0.75%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Over in Europe, they are on the lookout for a second wave of the pandemic. The European Center for Disease Prevention and Control has updated its numbers. 18 countries have seen an increase in cases. Greece, to pick just one random one, recorded 283 new cases on Sunday, its highest daily number since the beginning of this whole thing. But let us take a second look here, shall we? Because in spite of Sunday's numbers, Greece has actually managed this virus pretty well. Less than 10,000 total cases, only 254 deaths. Last time a lot of us heard from or about Greece, really, it was back in the days of the debt crisis and cratering confidence in the Greek government. So Marketplace's Stephen Beard decided to call some of the people he met back then to see what's changed now.
Throughout the debt crisis a decade ago, there was no more scathing a critic of the Greek character than Yanis Sarakatsanis, who, at the height of the country's financial woes, co-produced this satirical stage show in Athens. The show ridiculed what it called Greek fecklessness and indiscipline.
Ελλάδα 2011. Μια χώρα σε αποσύνθεση.
But today, even the acerbic Sarakatsanis has softened his view. In handling the pandemic, he says, Greece's self-esteem has been somewhat restored.
It is true that we felt proud, we felt competent as a country for once in our lives, and this whole thing boosts in our confidence.
In spite of the recent spike, Greece has done much better in curbing the spread of COVID-19 than many of its European partners, including its arch critic in financial matters, Germany. Athens has been five times more effective in limiting the mortality rate than Berlin. Why? The answer is simple, says Christos Mavrou, a department store sales manager.
The Greek government took measures very early compared to other countries.
In fact, in February, before a single Greek death, and he says the citizens eagerly complied with the restrictions. They found the government warning that the healthcare system might not cope all too credible.
They knew that the health system is very weak in Greece.
It's been ravaged by years of austerity mandated by the IMF and the EU. Another reason for compliance, says Mavrou, was the government's very strict enforcement of measures like mask wearing.
And, you know, Greek people are poor, so they don't want to pay the fines.
With the second oldest population in Europe after Italy, Greece could have so easily become a COVID-19 disaster zone. Another reason that it hasn't so far, says psychiatrist Dimitris Papadimitriadis, is one very benign aspect of Greek culture.
You see, Greece is still a country where family counts a lot. Too many generations stay under the same roof. So the youth are very protective of the older ones, the elderly, if I may say so.
So why the recent sharp spike in coronavirus cases? This tourist ferry leaving the port of Piraeus may be part of the problem. Bank worker Efi Panitsukapoulou says it was the albeit reduced influx of foreign visitors when travel restrictions were lifted in May that helped fuel the current upsurge.
Greece depends on tourism, so we have to open the borders for tourism. So I think that destroyed all the work that we have done. But we cannot do it without tourism.
It accounts for almost 20% of Greece's GDP and a big chunk of her family's income. Her husband is a leisure yacht skipper. His employment's been very patchy this year. There's a big hole in the family budget. But Effie feels nothing like the shame and stress of the debt crisis when Greece was a pariah in Europe.
Now that I know that everybody has the same problem, it's not stressful for me. We are all in the same boat.
For the first time in a decade, she actually feels optimistic about Greece's future. And so does book publisher Kostas Papadopoulos.
We can look at ourselves at the mirror now. Before we couldn't.
He feels encouraged that the centre-right government that's been in power for a year now took such decisive action at the start of the pandemic.
I think we trust the state a lot more than we used to trust it before. And I hope we're not going to be very disappointed in the future, in the near future. But I'm feeling optimistic, yes.
That optimism, though, could be sorely tested in the months ahead. The IMF has forecast the Greek economy will shrink by 10% this year, a bigger annual drop than any seen during the debt crisis. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
A story now about product and brand and reclaiming control. You might not be seeing Nike products at some major retailers much longer, both of the brick-and-mortar variety, Belk and Dillard's, to name a couple, and online as well at Zappos. The athletic wear maker is said to be cutting off a total of 9 retailers, part, Marketplace's Erica Barris tells us, of Nike's recent strategy of taking tighter control and selling more directly to consumers.
Nike is trying to sell its gear and make its customers feel special, like LeBron or Serena. Sam Poser, an analyst at Susquehanna Financial Group, says the stores Nike is dropping.
They were selling Nike product, but they weren't a place that were really doing something to enhance the Nike brand.
Nike wouldn't confirm or deny that it's cutting the store's accounts, but the company did say it's doubling down with strategic partners. Poser says that means retailers with splashy Nike displays. The company is also doubling down on its digital approach. Last year, Nike cut ties with Amazon, in part so it could collect its own data on customers. Jeff Gallick is a marketing professor at Carnegie Mellon.
They're going to know basically everything they want to know about a consumer, which might be information that was kept close to the chest by retailers. Now Nike has control of that data.
Taking control is the bottom line. So says Matt Powell, a sports industry advisor with the NPD Group.
They are able to control their message. They're able to control the product, show the product the way they want it shown, and to some extent have an impact on pricing.
With so many brick-and-mortar stores closing, Kamila Yanishevsky, an analyst at CFRA, says this is also a great way for Nike
to protect themselves from shrinking revenues that are already going to occur in that channel.
Nike's not the only brand that's taking more control. Yanishevsky says Ralph Lauren, Skechers, and others are doing the same thing. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
The final stop on our small business survey today is a retailer who, despite the pandemic, or maybe actually because of it, is having a bit of a moment right now.
This is Gary Merriman. I'm the owner of the Fish Hawk in Atlanta, Georgia, fly fishing specialty store. We've gotten a lot of foot traffic. The store's been very busy. We are limiting the number of people that can come in and requiring masks, and we have a hand sanitizing station outside before you enter. Rods have been one of the toughest things to get. One, the demand is high, but also the supply is very low. A lot of my manufacturers are U.S.-made rods, Washington State, Wisconsin. And so you can imagine, you know, they were going through, you know, a shutdown. You just never have seen so many people want to go fishing. Families were taking their kids. They needed something to do, and outdoors was the ticket. Our business was actually better than it would have been last year. So I don't know if that's sustainable. I just hope it levels off to a normal level and doesn't go below that. I know that's a wordy answer.
Yeah, take all the time you need, Mr. Merriman. That is Gary Merriman at the Fish Hawk in Atlanta, Georgia, rounding up our tour of small businesses in this economy. This final note on the way out today, Strange Corporate Bedfellows edition. Walmart says it is working with Microsoft on a deal to buy TikTok, the Chinese-owned social media platform. Strange bedfellows, I should say, until you remember that Walmart is fighting hard against Amazon, and buying TikTok comes with data on and access to hundreds of millions of potential Walmart customers. Also, TikTok CEO quit last night, so there's that too. All right, we are out of here, but not without your moment of economic context for this Thursday, bookending that quick item up at the top of the show about weekly unemployment claims still over a million. There is another labor market data point I like to look at on Thursdays. It's the number of Americans getting some kind of government unemployment assistance. 27 million people, just a tad more actually, are on some kind of jobless benefits for the week ended August the 8th. That is actually 27 million. That's an improvement from a week earlier, if you can believe that. Amir Babawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.